Accession number 11237, reel 3.
Admiral Morgan Giles, reel 3.
Yes, you were asking me about what motivated people to go and volunteer to serve in these fire ships. Well, of course, it was an extraordinary time in Britain, and I suppose you can say it was best summed up by Churchill when he said their finest hour, because the British people, their backs were to the wall. They realized it was a great threat, but you know, there wasn't much feel of doom and gloom about it. And I think the motives, obviously, of these people who volunteered for these things were mixed ones. Some of them did it for just sheer adventure. They were young and perhaps unmarried and that sort of thing. Some of them did it because you know, they'd get some preferment in their service, further their careers a bit and that sort of thing. And it is very interesting that the with hindsight, the Germans didn't go for these strange special exploits and special units. There was even a unit of the British Army solemnly called Popsky's Private Army, which did great things in the Mediterranean. And we had all these long-range desert groups and these extraordinary special units going on. But the Germans, who are pretty good at war, didn't go for this. They tended to say they didn't want to milk their enterprising people away from their traditional units. I don't know which is right. You might say the Italians were perhaps better than the Germans at this, and look at some of the exploits they did, which you may be talking about later on in Alexandria and so on.
To what extent do you think it was a feasible proposition, this Operation Lucid? Do you think it would have worked? Do you think it was a realistic project?
If it had even worked to some extent, it would have been an enormous uplift for the nation, which wanted it desperately at that time. So you can see why Churchill set it up. You can see that it appealed to him. You can see why they got a sort of World War One hero, Augustus Agar VC, to head it up. And it had to be done in a hell of a hurry, more for a public relations exercise, I suspect, than anything else. Although, had it worked, it would have been very effective in burning out these barges. I don't suppose it would have stopped the complete stopped the complete invasion, but it would have certainly set it back. But if I continue with the story about how it went, you can see why it wasn't really very feasible, because the ships were so old that the first time we went out, they, instead of doing the, I think, 6 knots we were planning for them to get across there in the darkness, they did about 2.5 knots because the ships were so old and battered and nobody knew how to work things. And what's more, the mixture of petrol and oil and so on I've been talking about leaked through the rivet holes in the tanks down into the stoke holes and was sizzling on the hot floor plates down there. And the stokers, trying to run these ships across, came up on deck, and everybody thought they were drunk, but it was only petrol fumes. So the ships simply, you know, wouldn't do it.
Their minds had been affected by the petrol fumes.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes, they were drunk on petrol fumes. So we came back into Sheerness and cobbled the ships together and got one better ship in place of one of the worst of them and that sort of business. And we set out again, and this time there was a most enormous southerly gale, which of course partly delayed the thing, and also it would have blown the mixture out of the harbours instead of into them. This is the last thing we wanted. And we turned back again from that. Well, then the moon and the tides and things weren't right, and we had to wait several weeks. By this time, this breathlessly secret thing was very widely known. And all the barmaids in Chatham would be serving you a drink and saying, "Are you in the fireships, dearie?" You know, that sort of thing. See, it wasn't really good at all. So much so that when we set out the third time, the German searchlights were not up in the air. There was an air raid mounted simultaneously with it, but they were all sweeping on the surface. And that was quite revealing. And I was in a destroyer with Gussie Agar as a covering force taking this lot across. And our stern was blown off by a mine, so they'd obviously come across with some E-boats and put mines in the swept channel that we were using. So the thing was cancelled. and never came to anything. And all the volunteers went back to general service or to other strange deeds. So it was a flop, but it was it was an exciting and it was one of the first ideas Churchill had to do something dramatic, you see. It appealed to him very much. And there's no doubt that technically the mixture worked and all that sort of thing.
Can we go on now to the Mediterranean and HMS Nile?
Yes. I was sent out to the Mediterranean because they thought that this fireship technique, which apart from the failure of Lucid itself, the technique was quite well approved and the war was rather stuck there, and they thought we might be able to do something similar in the Mediterranean against Italian ports. And we had a rather an, a strange passage out there in a convoy and merchant ships. And I think Christmas Day, and I was in a merchant ship, a lot of naval drafts going out to the Med, and it was a terrible gale in the Bay of Biscay, and as the sailors say, black on a black cat's bladder, and there was an even darker patch on our port side, and a little blue light came and said, convoy scatter. And I said to the merchant service off the watch, being young and silly, all right, I'll deal with this. And so I read this, and I got a little, my little blue lamp and made back, ha, ha, Merry Christmas to you too. And there was a pause, and then their blue light came back and said, convoy scatter. And before he'd finished the word scatter the second time, there was gunfire, and it was the hippos in the convoy. So we knew they meant something. And that was very interesting, because the convoy did scatter then. We saw the captain opening his envelope for his route to take us away and so on. And this is a compliment to the merchant service, I may just turn aside for a second, because any naval officer knows that the sole raison d'etre for the Navy is to protect our seaborne trade, and it's a pity that in peacetime we don't get to know the merchant service better than we do. But of course, in wartime, we know them very much better. But this old captain of this ship, I won't name the ship, was, I thought, a very bluff old Yorkshireman, and I thought a drunken old so-and-so. He had a very good skinful in the, down in the mess the night before and that sort of thing. When it came to it, everybody fell silent, and I have a very vivid image of this old captain crouched under the lee of his wheelhouse, completely in charge of the situation, everybody just stopping, turning and looking to him to see what happened next. And it illustrates the point that the merchant service skippers who have masters, who have no naval discipline act to help them or to exert their authority or anything like that, have nothing but their personality to depend on. They are fantastic chaps. And nothing that's ever done for the merchant ships, politically or any other way, must ever be done to diminish the status of the master. Anyway, we got on to Gibraltar quite safely.
So the Hipper didn't...
The Hipper was driven off by two cruisers, I think it was the Berwick and the Bonaventure, but she was driven off, and she didn't want to get in a battle, and I think she fired at one ship, which was a straggler, but she didn't do any damage, really. There was a little corvette there, too, and I remember when this came through, it was just becoming light, and seeing this little corvette turning hard away to starboard to go try and drive off the Hipper. Ridiculous, pathetic, really, but just doing what she had to. And this thing was more or less, with the sea that was running and going on to full speed, was more or less jumping out of the sea. It's another image I carry very vividly in my mind. And when you come to think of how men existed and lived and remained efficient and retained their sense of humour under the conditions that there were in the mess decks of those small ships in the Atlantic, all those war years, it beggars imagination. Quite extraordinary. A fantastic tribute to them, really. And they kept a sense of humour somehow. It must have been absolutely intolerable. Anyway, We got into Gibraltar. We were then blown ashore in a gale, part of our moorings, transferred to another ship. And when we went on through the Mediterranean, we were spotted by some aircraft. And a great cloud of Stukas, which had newly arrived in Sicily, came out to attack us just south of Malta. And fortunately for us, the HMS Illustrious had just, from Malta, had just come out to join us and sort of protect us. And of course, the Stukas left us alone and diverted their attention to the Illustrious. And I had a view from about a mile away of the Illustrious taking the most fantastic bombing I've ever seen. The whole ship was absolutely wreathed in spray and splashes. And it was a lovely day, and there were sort of rainbows forming in the spray around her, smoke and flame from God knows what. And as you know, or as is well known, a bomb hit her and went down one of the lift wells and exploded, and she had this big armored deck about 4 inches thick, and it had no release holes in it. And I saw her in Alexandria afterwards with the whole of her deck humped up several feet on the center line, looking rather like the roof of a cottage, all this thick deck. Anyway, of course, the convoy scuttled on as best it could, and the Illustrious went on back into Malta. It was the first time I was close hands with Stukas, and it was pretty impressive, I must say. We went to Athens, where the Germans were shortly expected to invade. We had a few days there. And I remember seeing the Greek soldiers dressed up like ballet dancers in these strange little, I forget what the name of their uniform is, boarding a train. I saw them going up to the front to fight in the snow, and I noticed one of them had strange little slippers, and one of them, his sole of his shoe was actually held on with elastic bands. And coming out of Athens, the next ship in the line was torpedoed. We went on, we eventually got safely to Alexandria. And when I reported to the commander-in-chief there and said, I'm told to come out here and talk to you about fire ships, he said, don't talk nonsense, there's a war on here now, and we can't spare ships for that sort of thing, because the Western Desert was going on. Of course, any few ships they had, and there were far too few, were needed for taking stores and things up into the Western Desert. And so that's where I eventually ended up.
You haven't said anything about what kind of a ship Nile was to live on and to work on.
HMS Nile was only a ship name. There was no such thing as HMS Nile. Any ship in the Navy has to have something floating. It was probably just a motorboat in Alexandria Harbour or something. Anybody in the Navy has to be on the books of some floating ship. And HMS Nile was only a name, just like HMS President is for anybody in the Admiralty or around the world. And you'll see some of my future entries, HMS President. And it merely means I was born on the books for pay of that particular establishment. So they said, no, you can forget all about your fire ships, but we've got trouble now in the Suez Canal because the German aircraft are coming over and dropping magnetic mines into the Suez Canal. Well, this was a very strange story, because the Suez Canal pilots are a very international gang. And there was one, believe it or not, whose name was Prickwinkle. And Herr Prickwinkle disappeared about a fortnight before the war broke out, without trace. And in fact, it was subsequently discovered that he was planted there by the German Admiralty and had been withdrawn when there was a threat of war, and was advising the Luftwaffe where to drop their mines in the Suez Canal, because some parts of the canal are sandy and some parts of the canal are rocky, and they obviously hoped to sink a ship in the rocky bit where it wouldn't be so easy to salvage them or dredge a way around them. And when I got to Ismailia, where the headquarters of this flag officer in charge was, there was a perfectly delightful, charming old man called Admiral Sir James Peapon, who was in charge of the Suez Canal and the Red Sea area, called back from retirement, as the Navy very rudely say, a retread, and he was the most delightful and courtly old man, and he used to appear in the operations room late at night in his dinner jacket after dinner, pacing up and down, having never heard of a magnetic mind or anything to do with them, or any more than any of us had, pacing up and down, saying, "Oh dear, life is difficult, isn't it?" And of course, when a new threat comes like that, they tend to get the wildest suggestions. People with glass-bottom boats to see where people suggested glass-bottom boats to try and find the mines. People wanted performing dolphins. One organization wanted, or one suggestion was that they should put things like trawls on one bank of the canal, lead a line across from that through a snatch block round a palm tree, and then have teams of camels to drag these trawls across the canal and scoop them up on the far side. In fact, the minesweeping technique was very, very elementary in those days. There were no proper double L sweeps. They were only being developed in England at the time. That's the magnetic sweep, which was eventually successful against the magnetic mine. And the best way to go about it was to have teams of mine watchers. Well, the best way of all to go about it was to have plenty of anti-aircraft guns along the canal, so the aircraft were driven off before they ever dropped the mines. But there weren't enough of those. So the next thing was to line the banks, both sides, with watchers of every conceivable nationality, even Egyptian troops and so on, to watch whether a splash of a mine went in. And then you could send a diver down at slack tide to find where the mine was and countermine it, or if possible recover it. There were some very brave chaps out there trying to recover these mines and take them, get them ashore and see how they worked, because that was the urgency at the time, of course, to see how they worked. There was also a selection of acoustic mines included with the magnetics, and they used to run speedboats up and down at high speed to try and touch these off, and the idea was that the high speed boat was going so fast that she'd be passed before the mine went up. And I saw a coastal motorboat type of thing, beautifully built boat, built in England and provided to the Suez Canal service long before the war, as kind of dispatch boats for the directors to run up and down in a dramatic way. And this thing was requisitioned and being used for this purpose, and a mine went up slap underneath her. And I was standing on the bank watching this, just opposite. And I sprinted along to the nearest transit, they call it, that's the canal station, to go out in a boat and see if there are any survivors. And the, rather typically, the little bureaucratic Frenchman who was in charge of this thing came along and wanted a signature for the boat. Anyway, I don't know what to do about that. And we were rowing out in a boat, and there was an Egyptian or Arab in the boat with me, and there was suddenly a great flapping and flashing alongside the boat, and I thought, my God, it must be a survivor. And the Arab was leaning over the side, and I looked. All that happened was there was a fish that was stunned and was just gradually coming round, and this Arab thought he'd just take the opportunity to pick up his lunch as he went. When we got out there, there were three men in the boat. The stoker was never seen anything of again, and one was quite okay, and the other one was bad, but all right, survived. But the sea was covered with scum from this explosion, and the boat, which was a lightly built coastal motorboat type of thing, the wood had completely disintegrated. It was like 100,000 pencils, just pencil-sized bits of timber floating around, like a pencil that's come in half with the wet. Most extraordinary. Of course, clearing these mines out of the canal was absolutely vital, because otherwise everything had to be landed through Suez, and all our tanks, ships full of personnel, stores, ammunition, food, everything had to be unloaded in Suez if we couldn't get through the canal, and it was closed for days and weeks at a time. It was appalling, because the army were trying to get all their reinforcements and all the things they need up through and discharge them inside the Mediterranean ports, where there are more ports to use. Every possible effort was made to get rid of these mines. A lot were cleared by divers. There's a legendary character called Jim Irish, who's a kind of local contractor in Portside that every naval sweat knows all about. And he was contracted to provide 12 skin divers. That normally their job is to dive over the side and pick up coins from the tourist ships pre-war. And he provided 12 men in a boat, which was supposed to dive, and the assistant fleet torpedo officer was watching this rather closely, and he watched that six of them were actually diving, and some of them, the other six, in fact, hopping over the side and splashing around a little bit and then climbing back into the dinghy and saying, boom, you know, that sort of thing, tiling themselves down and that sort of thing, and one not diving at all. And, of course, they weren't divers. They could hardly even swim. But Jim Irish wasn't going to lose the opportunity of providing and being paid for 12 contract divers if he could only muster six, and that's how he played it. So it was full of strange stories like that. Now, there were a lot of little requisitioned trawlers trying to sweep. And one of the most successful was a converted Wellington bomber, which the Royal Air Force from one of their stations down there, which I had a lot to do with later, was running. And it was called the Flying Wedding Ring. And it had a most enormous magnetic coil slung underneath it from wingtip to wingtip, protruding out beyond the nose and hitched up under its tail. And this thing, I don't know how the wingspan of a Wellington is. If it's 70 feet, this thing was about 60 feet wide. And the aircraft was completely stripped out, and inside it was a Gypsy 6 engine from a little light aircraft, a Moth or something like that, driving a generator, which I believe was actually a motor taken from a tram in Alexandria, hitched up. And this drove a magnetic field, you see, a magnetic current round this coil. And that, as every schoolboy knows, produces a magnetic field. So if the aircraft flew low down, its magnetic field would pass over the mine and blow up the mine, but by that time the aircraft had gone ahead of it and the splash would come up clear of the aircraft. Well, that was fine, but there were various snags about it. One was that there were some mines which were very sensitive and might blow up under the aircraft immediately. The other thing was that the air was so hot out there that the aircraft's own engines overheated, so it couldn't fly too fast. And if it didn't fly fast enough and flew low enough for the magnetic field to reach the mines, then the splash would come up underneath the tail of the aircraft and hit it into the sea, you see. I hope I'm making this clear, but magnetic mines are not bobbing about like the ordinary conventional mines. They're like a great big black sausage, and they're dropped in on a parachute, shed their parachute, and they lie on the bottom. So you obviously have to fly very low over them for the magnetic field to reach them. And this thing used to blow up a lot of mines, but it could only do it in the very early morning when the air was cool enough that the engines itself didn't overheat. So by hook and by crook, the canal was opened and got a few ships through and then closed again. There was a rather strange sequel to it, because one staff officer suggested that they should net in the canal, and then when a raid was carried out, the hole in the net would indicate where the mine had dropped through, and then divers could easily go down and deal with it. And Admiral Cunningham, the commander-in-chief, said, I like that. That's a solution a seaman can understand. He didn't understand all these electric sweeps and things. Let's net in the canal. And Commander Lofty Power, who was the staff officer of plans, sat down, did a sum on his blotting paper and said, "Sir, this will require 93 million miles of cod line to make the netting, to net in the canal." Anyway, you can imagine this suggestion going around the staff, and eventually a compromise was reached that they would net in a 10 kilometre experimental stretch of the canal. And some poor old boatswain was put in charge of this, and he spent months getting these nets made and stuff shipped out from India and rigging up posts on the bank and all this stuff. And one day he came along to Alexandria and went into the staff and said, "They're ready, sir." "What are ready?" they said. Nets, what are you talking about?" Everybody's forgotten all about it in Palestine. The war had swept on and they were no longer needed. Anyway, they thought they would try them out. So they dragged the nets across one night. One poor torpedo gunner was drowned by his dinghy, was swept underneath them. But anyway, the nets got across all right. And they were going to pull them back in the morning. But in the morning, they went out with the shore parties to pull them back, and they found that the desert Arabs on the east bank had come in, found miles and miles of lovely rope, and cut them, pinched the lot, and gone off into the desert with them, and there were no ropes, no hauling over lines to pull the nets back again. And relentlessly and remorselessly around the corner came the northbound convoy, about six merchant ships, and when they steamed into these nets, because nobody could get them out of their way, the scenes of chaos were such as I've never seen rivaled. If you go through the Suez Canal now, you can still see some of the stumps of old concrete stumps looking like rotting teeth in a film star's gums, still there. In the end, the LL mine sweeps were sent out from England, and the problem of mines in the canal was no longer a problem. And further than that, when the army advanced in the western desert, the range was too long for the Germans to find it worthwhile to get to the canal to lay them anymore. So that problem, without being specifically solved, was in fact evaporated.
I think after this period, you were concerned with relieving the Tobruk siege.
Yes. My boss in those days, and for a large part of the war, was a magnificent man, then Commander Watson. He afterwards became an admiral and commander-in-chief in South Africa. He was Dimmock Watson. And he was a man who could explain exactly what he wanted done to me in quarter of an hour. After quarter of an hour with him, I could understand exactly what he wanted done for a month. A marvelous man to work for. But he said, look, there's some small mines, only about as big as, two or three times as big as a football, that's all, which have been designed. They were called R mines, R for river. They're very simple little things. And they were supposed originally to be taken up into Switzerland or somewhere and in the early part of the war and drifted down the Rhine in the hope that they would get in under bridges and barges and things and do some damage inside Germany. But that scheme didn't seem to go ahead very much, or if it did, I don't know about it. But some of these mines were spare, and they were sent out to Egypt. And I was told to take a little converted Norwegian whaler thing up the desert and try and lay these inside or off them the harbours that the Germans were using further west in the desert to impede them. When I got into Tobruk, I was told, I said I've got these mines and I've got to go up and lay them in Benghazi. And the naval officer in charge said, well, you better hurry because Benghazi fell to the Germans 2 days ago, and if you don't look out, they'll be in here any moment. So the door had clanged. It was too late to use those mines. But I stored them in a cave in Tobruk. And the little taller thing went back to, the little whaler thing went back to Alexandria. And I became part of the port party at Tobruk. And as the Germans were by this time using some very small harbours, one called Bomber, I remember, and Derna and places like that, there was one of the Yangtze River gunboats we were talking about earlier called HMS Aphis and HMS Ladybird. And Aphis was detailed to take me and some of these mines out and creep in at night and lay them off these small ports, again in the hope that when the Germans were using them, then they'd be